Well, let's just get to it. Welcome back. This is Person of Interest with me, Natalie Jones. This is volume two of Tim Spector. We talked for 90 minutes total, and I really made sure that I asked pretty much every question that y'all wrote to me, DM me on Instagram and Facebook, and a lot of people texted and emailed. So I tried to ask as many as I could. So we do a lot of random questions, and then the second half, we get really into discussion about health and wellness in general. And I love his overarching theme and theory about health and wellness and gut microbiome in general. And that comes up in pretty much every answer, which is to diversify and less processed foods, which I freaking love that. More plants, the better. Excitingly, I'm on the Zoe journey right now. I'm wearing a blood glucose monitor, and I sent in a stool sample and a blood sample. When I get my test results, Tim is actually going to walk me through them, and we're going to do another podcast, and I'm going to, gosh, put all of my results out there. We'll see how this goes. For right now, please enjoy this, the second volume of my interview with Tim Spector, and he is Zooming, and you can hear a lawnmower in the back a little bit, but that's okay. That's just laugh, y'all. Like, subscribe, do all those things. Remember, follow Tim on Twitter at Tim Spector and on Instagram at Join Zoe and Join Zoe on Facebook and also joinzoe.com. Enjoy this.
Well, talking about, let's go back to diet, furthering that when it comes to children. We have here, what are most foods kids are missing in their diets? And what is something you can communicate to parents to help their kids gut biome and health-wise?
The problem in the US and the UK is that we tend to treat kids very differently to adults. And we give them children's menus and children's foods in the supermarkets. And most countries don't do that. This has been a way of driven by marketing, and it's really a way of giving kids more and more ultra processed food, even than adults. Mm-hmm. And so they have their special kids yogurts and things like this, which are basically just sugar.
Yeah.
Contain nothing good at all. And, you know, in general, they have less fiber, they have more chemicals. And so, you know, they, in general, should be trying and eating what the adults are eating and get them used to real food earlier. You know, there's all this stuff a few years back about, oh, well, you know, we must give them bland food as they'll get allergies. The opposite seems to be true. The more you can introduce diversity early to kids, you have a small window of opportunity before the age of three when they start throwing things back at you. To get lots of food into them and get them used to strange textures, get them used to broccoli, spinach, more bitter flavors. Because at the moment, most kids are just given sweet things. And so obviously they, you know, every human is evolved like sweet things, but their threshold gets higher and higher. So it's very hard to get anything that is like a natural vegetable for them to like. So it's about introducing these things early, getting them to touch it, feel it, play with it. And I think that's the key in a way to get a variety of vegetables and plants, just like you would adults. And even if they reject it, just keep, you know, giving it back to them until they start to realize it's fine. So I think that's the number one thing, because they're generally deprived of fiber, most kids. And the bigger variety they have, you know, they need their immune systems just like we do. That first 3 years is probably the most crucial in terms of building up their own gut microbes and their own immune system. So again, diversity of plants, keeping them away from ultra sweet stuff. You know, I'm not saying never, but, you know, they shouldn't always be having there with a fruit juice. No kid needs fruit juice other than as a special treat. And getting them used to interesting flavors, textures, bitterness, the full sourness, you know, the full range. The Koreans introduced their kids very early to kimchi.
Gotcha. What did you serve your kids when they were young?
Oh, the wrong things. I got it wrong. You know, I was just using the, traditional medical advice, which in retrospect was wrong. And of course, you know, I realize they're going to be, you know, moms and dads listening out there who've got, you know, terrible toddlers that you know, are, and they just do anything for peace and quiet. So I understand that. I'm just telling you what they should do, not necessarily what I was able to do. But we did have a wide variety of foods. And so I do remember giving my kids curries and olives and pickled foods very early on. And I think, although they, you know, might have rejected it later, they did come back to it because they had a sort of memory of it. So I think we went half the way there. I didn't do as good a job as I would have liked to have done. but nobody's perfect. So, you know.
So what are some easy chemicals that parents can read on labels to avoid as much as possible when buying food for their kids?
First, look at the label, and if it's got 10 ingredients or more, you know it's ultra processed.
Yeah,
that's the first sort of warning sign. And we know in general that if you give an equivalent of ultra processed and whole foods to kids or adults, even the same calories to start with, they'll eat more during the day. And so it actually increases appetite through ways we don't yet understand. Yeah. So it is the key, I think, on any label is working out how processed is this food. Now, we all eat processed foods, including myself. It's impossible to avoid, but getting to know what the labels mean, and this, you know, I talk about this in Spoonfed, is an art, because the label is there to fool you. It's there to hide things, and it sticks labels on it like low cal, low fat, you know, high in vitamin C, high in zinc. You've got to ignore all that and just say, how many ingredients does it have? Can I spell or any of them? You know, would I have any of them in my kitchen? And if you don't recognize most of them, it's ultra processed food. And I think that's the most important message to give. The least ingredients that you have on the label, generally the less processed it is, and the better it is. You know, and if there's anything else, I mean, fiber content is good in general. And most ultra processed foods have very little fiber. That's another clue.
Yeah.
And you may or may not worry about sugars, but beware of just things saying low in sugar, because it's all relative. And that just means they're giving you artificial sweeteners instead, which for your kid will just give them an even sweeter tooth going forward, and may cause problems, we think, for their gut microbes as well. So it's a jungle out there. And, you know, and ideally, you know, in the ideal world, we wouldn't buy things in packets. We'd be like going to our Italian or Spanish market, just picking everything up and seeing what it is and making our own food. But in the real world, in, you know, downtown Cincinnati, you've got to go to a store and get your stuff.
Yeah.
And you need to know how to look at that label. And, you know, when you've got a choice, try and make the one based on that. And if, you know, and it's that list of ingredients and those names that you wouldn't have in your kitchen. They're the ones to avoid. We mustn't get fixated on one particular ingredient. I think that's a danger, because the manufacturer is always changing the names anyway. Every year they update it, you know, so there's about, there's 40 names for sugar.
Yeah.
Right.
Glucose, sucrose, which ones should we really be worrying about? Or which ones should we pay attention to? What does it mean?
All of them. They're all there to fool you. You know, they call it reduced sugars. They call it agave syrup. You know, make it sound healthier. It comes from a cactus. You know, beet juice. You know, berry juice. You know, it's all the same. So I think that's the other thing we need to look at, is realize that they're trying to fool you. They're allowed to do it by law, and they will keep changing the names of it. You know, there was this thing about, it was bigger in Europe than the US, but we had things like e-numbers. These were special additives. So all the companies did was they just changed to their chemical name, and then they changed it to having something that was modified, you know, so you can have celery extract or something.
Yeah.
Which sounds very healthy, but actually isn't. And it's just it's to get around and to give it what they call a clean label. So there's a lot of fiddling goes on. So don't get obsessed about one item. Look at the whole package and just look at fiber, look at sugar, look at the number of ingredients and make your choice based on that. And just say, you know, is there something I could buy that's a lot simpler instead? Put two things together myself rather than buying it already made. In general, that's always going to be a healthier option.
How do you feel about microplastics and microplastics in our world and our food, and especially them lowering our testosterone levels?
I'm certainly worried about microplastics. Mm-hmm. And for people who eat a lot of fish, and like me, who love mussels and the occasional oyster, it's a bit of a worry.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones that absorb all these plastics from the sea. But I don't think the data is out there yet about their health consequences. So I don't think there's any solid evidence that it's microplastics are responsible for any of our health issues at the moment. But given the rate at which they're going up, they certainly could be. So I just think it's another reason that we can't switch to eating fish instead of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another argument that we need to be really focusing on plant-based things that aren't as affected by microplastics as other areas. I mean, there are also microplastics in the air. So in certain parts of the world, you actually breathe in microplastics as well without having to eat, which is also worrying. So yeah, you know, whole plastics and buying food in plastic, which encourages it, is another bad thing. So again, try and look for stores that use less plastic, and you know, where you can vote with your wallet, do so.
So what do you think is the influence of the chemicals we're talking about in our food and microplastics in causing things like rheumatoid arthritis and autoimmune disorders that are prevalent so much?
I don't think there's enough evidence yet to blame microplastics for that. I think, you know, microplastics are part of a big picture of our whole environment changing,
mm-hmm.
and includes pollution with particles, you know, from you know, automobiles, you know, whether you live near a street that's got pollution in it, near factories, effects of global warming, sulfur, you know, reduce overuse, killing off microbes in our normal environment. There's too many things to.
Okay.
Let's, you know, I think all of these things have a role, but we mustn't get obsessed about any one of them. The important thing is to keep a general picture and say, yeah, you know, if you eat what's good for your microbes, generally you'll be eating what's good for the planet. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, then we'll all be healthier. And these three things together do fit very nicely. So it's generally proven that, you know, a plant-based diet with, you know, that's healthy for us is going to be healthy for us. And it's also healthy for the planet, and you know, we'll have less plastic and less pollution. So I think keep the big picture in mind.
Okay.
Don't get too obsessed with this stuff, which may or may not be true in the future, but there'll always be something else to worry about.
So if you're just starting plant-based or you don't know much about it, what kind of guidelines can you give to someone who's going into the grocery store and there's so many plant-based options now that seem to be incredibly ultra processed? What are some things we should keep in mind when making that decision at the grocery store?
Well, I think I would start go to the vegetable aisle rather than the ready-made food aisle.
The imitation meat burgers and hot dogs and that type of stuff. So are those really better for us than beef or chicken if someone's making the decision for health reasons?
It's sort of comparing apples and oranges, really.
Okay.
If you want to eat a cheap processed burger, you're probably better off having the vegan alternative, right?
Even if it's full of a bunch of crap, essentially?
Yeah, because the processed burger will also be full of crap, right? If you're going to, you want to get the very best, you want to spend money, no option, on the very finest free-range, grass-fed Japanese beef and have it that way, you're probably better off with that option. Okay, so I think for all the cheap ultra-processed foods, my personal view is that the increasing number of processed versions of that are at least as good for you as those ones, and much better for the planet. Okay, so you are getting generally more fiber, you are getting some of the nutrients, the polyphenols, etc., that are good for your microbes, than if you just had the cheapest ultra-processed meat products with a bit of bread and scrapings off the floor put in, which is in what's in your average cheap bologna or cheapest, frozen burgers. So, which are also often full of antibiotics and other things during the process of rearing those animals. So I think I think we have to realize that a lot of these alternatives are a way of getting people to think differently, to think that we are moving to a stage where very soon the good meat alternatives will be cheaper than the meat, even the cheapest meat. And at that point, I think shoppers will start to switch over and we'll see the end of the mass meat industry. Wow. And there's also data showing that meat, stem cell meat, this is laboratory made meat, within 5 years is going to be cheaper than the average burger.
Oh, no way. How do you feel about eating insects now to supplement, like, for protein and fiber? Do you support that?
I love that idea. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, me too.
So crickets and these black flies, which have these, it doesn't really nice to sound like it, but they produce these maggots.
Yes, they are.
You dry them up, but they're basically protein. They're just full of protein and they're totally sustainable. You know, you grow them and they just eat waste from restaurants and things. Yeah. And they are gaining traction. You know, you can buy them now in Whole Foods and
on Amazon,
cricket flour everywhere. And there's snacks. So definitely alternate ways of protein that are probably better for you than some of the cheaper alternatives are definitely there. So I don't think any, I will still eat meat once a month, right?
Only once?
Occasionally twice, but
it's
gotta be super good, high quality, right? I'm not gonna have any rubbish.
Okay. And
I generally have a small amount of it, helps my B12 levels, so I don't need supplements. And I think it's going to be hard ever to replace that as a culinary item in terms of nutrition and taste. But I think 90% of all the meat can be replaced by these vegan alternatives or these insect alternatives or these lab stem cell alternatives within 5 years. So we're going to see a big revolution in this. And that's why all the meat companies are investing in these other companies. Because they know it's coming.
Do you eat eggs?
I do, yes. Free range organic eggs. And I know that's a growing market in the US. Yeah. People do want to know their eggs come from happier hens than the ones in the past, or the other ones that aren't so lucky. They're a good source of nutrition. No evidence they're bad for you, as long as you don't overdo it. You know, I wouldn't have more than one a day on average.
Really? Okay.
So I think the people who have three or four a day, I think are overdoing it, but the data isn't very clear. Maybe, one or two, but not three or four eggs a day.
Really? So I don't eat very much meat, but I do eat a lot of eggs, about three or four a day, like for breakfast and dinner. Oh, God, no way. Well, I'll stop doing that now.
I'm giving you epidemiology, which is the average, right?
Yeah.
As we've explained, no one's average. So you may, it may be okay for you, but.
Well, I'm about to find out. And what, when you eat meat once a month, what meat, what are you eating?
Well, I've been in Spain a lot of the summer. So I would actually go for the very finest ham, which is called pata negra, which is like the gourmet ham, which these animals are mollycoddled and they're fed on acorns and mushrooms and live in the wild. And yeah, they just taste fantastic. And, or, you know, if I was at a Japanese restaurant, I'd get some Wagyu beef, something special. I'd have some venison. But it has to be special, because I actually now find, you know, I can't overdo the meat once I've given it up, and I don't like those big portions. I couldn't just have that giant T-bone on my plate anymore. Just doesn't work for me, you know. And meat is fine. We've shown this. There's nothing wrong with good quality meat, but it takes up room on your plate that you should leave for lots of different vegetables. And I think that's the key here. It's trying to focus on complete meals, not about single items. It's saying, you know, what does my plate contain, and on a sort of regular basis. And if you think of it that way, you can have a small amount of meat as long as you've got four different veg on there, or, you know, plenty of beans and mushrooms. That's fine, you know, not a problem. But it, most people don't. They will just have, you know, the steak and fries, and that's it.
This is kind of on a totally other realm. My family has ataxia. My mother is the fourth person in her family to be, she's on the downward. She specifically has spinocerebellar ataxia. And I'm curious, do you think that, because that also is an autoimmune thing, do you think that any of these environmental factors are affecting things like a genetic disorder that she has?
We've seen big changes. I mean, I used to study rheumatoid arthritis a lot and lupus, and we've seen big changes over the years in how common these diseases are. Mm-hmm. And genetics explains about half of the problem, but not all of it. And our genes do interact with our environment. And it's quite likely that the microbiome also plays a role. And we know that generally our microbiomes as a population have got worse over the last 50 years as our diets have got worse, and because of pollution. So I think the microbes are a key to actually regulating our immune system. So making sure we don't get food allergies and we don't get autoimmune diseases by overreacting. And so any change in the microbiome can influence your autoimmune state. And as we've said, microbiome can react to pollution, smoke, antibiotics, microplastics, whatever. So all of these things are possible.
In your genetic studies, did you find real evidence about the mind power over epigenetics, like meditating yourself into changing your genes?
Sadly, not. No.
So that's not true. I mean, you know, like I've.
But you can eat yourself. You can eat yourself into changing your genes.
Okay.
So there's plenty of evidence in animals that you give animals the right diet, they can tweak their genes in the right direction or the wrong direction. So.
Really.
You know, yeah.
And every human can do that.
Well, we haven't done enough studies in humans, but we certainly know in lab animals, we can easily regulate, turn genes on and off through changes in diet, yeah. But the reason I moved from epigenetics to the microbiome is because I think the effects are much larger in the microbiome. Mm. And we know definitely that you can influence your microbes by a change in diet very rapidly and in a visible way. And it's much easier to test your microbiome than it is to test your genes or your epigenes. So I think, you know, the emphasis really should be on, you know, most of your genes you're stuck with, right? And, but it's only half the story. And so really you need to focus on what you can change. And that for everyone is improving their diet, to get the best results for themselves. And that means doing some basic things for your gut microbes, but it's also personalizing your diet to fit your own metabolism. And that's what we've been doing with these PREDICT studies and the ZOE studies, et cetera. And I think, you know, we may not understand all the mechanisms because science is still evolving, but, you know, we should follow up the things we do know that work.
What do you think is some of the most dangerous diet or health myths that are big in the media and that are sensationalized that we can, that you can teach us to ignore?
Well, I mean, the general one is that calories are the most important thing about food, and that is the number one myth.
Okay.
And so we should absolutely ignore that. Never pick a food based on its calorie count. It's just, you should look at its quality. That's actually the driving force, and that's behind a lot of the advice behind the ZOE product as well, which moves away from this idea of calorie restriction, which has never been shown to work or help anyone long term in terms of diets. So I think that's propagated by the huge industry behind it. You know, there's a $1 trillion industry behind the diet business, and that's all led by calories. So that's the big one. I think the other one is that exercise is a way to lose weight. Again, lots of vested interest in that. You know, the big drinks companies are always sponsoring the Olympics and sporting events. They want parents to think that if their kids, you know, play football, then they, you know, they can eat as much junk as they want. It doesn't matter. Absolutely not true. And then, of course, I think, me personally, and this is where we may disagree, that, you know, you can cure lots of things with supplements.
You do believe that?
No, I don't.
No, I don't either. How do you feel about, I'm dying to know how you feel about supplements and vitamins.
So to me, yeah, one of the most overhyped things in nutrition are supplements. It's an unregulated cowboy world, really. So basically, virtually no supplements have been shown in any randomized trial to work in humans. And that goes for 99.5% of them. So when everyone's always recommending a supplement to someone or another, and people spend, you know, thousands of dollars on them every year, and it's crazy for something that really doesn't work. And they should be spending their money on buying whole food, real food, you know, learning to cook better, this kind of stuff, which they say, oh, I can't afford that. But, you know, 50% of all Americans have at least one supplement a day.
So if I'm putting these powders in my smoothie, that isn't growing the gut diversity, or that isn't helping me at all in any way?
I don't know is the answer. Okay. They do vary. There are some that are better than others, but generally there's no evidence behind it. And it's quite interesting because I believe that things like some of these fiber supplements, there's something called inulin, which is quite a common one, and it's now being added to foods, processed foods. We did some trials on this in our twins in London, and it turns out that you give this inulin powder, thinking it's going to improve the diversity of your gut microbes, and it doesn't actually do that. It just helps a certain few of them grow because they like that particular inulin, because it's just too specific. And real food, if you gave real food, it contains maybe 1,000 chemicals, whereas if you just give one, it can give a distorted idea of what's going on. So that's really understanding the difference between food and supplements. So okay. Food, you've got 500 to 1,000 different chemicals. A supplement, you've got one. And, you know, why we don't know what's good about a food, we're guessing that it's that one bit of it that might be useful. But we're doing it in the dark. So some supplements are going to be harmful. Some might be helpful. That's why, on average, we don't see any benefit.
Okay. So sometimes taking too many supplements obviously can be a bad thing.
Yeah. No, some studies have shown increased rates of cancer and things like that in people taking too many supplements. Yeah. But, you know, if people spent as much time looking for supplements, you know, looking for good food and how to cook it, you know, we wouldn't have any problems.
Yeah.
But there's true. But there's not money. Like, big money's not behind it, you know.
I was gonna say that's just not how the world is. You know, fun fact: my dad has cancer. He has stage 4 cancer, and he stopped taking his vitamins, and he started to feel a lot better. So he used to take 30 vitamins a day. He's a big bulky guy, or a big muscle guy. Lifts weights his whole life. So do certain food sensitivities make you more susceptible to infections?
In general, people who have a lot of food sensitivities or food allergies have a less healthy gut microbiome, which in general would make them more susceptible to infections.
Okay. And if someone who wants to improve their gut health, where do they go? Do they go to their doctor? Do they go to a gastro? Do they go to a nutritionist? Where can they start to, other than you and the Zoe program, where can someone go to start to start their journey of improving their gut?
Well, unless you're very lucky, you're not going to have a doctor who knows anything about this anywhere near you. And so probably I'd go for a nutritionist to look at your diet and reassess it and give you some advice about what's in the foods you're eating. You'd keep a diary and you'd get some idea of what's going on. I think they're more likely to know the latest that's happening than sadly most doctors.
Okay. How do you feel about cleanses? I recently did the salt water, the master cleanse. Ugh. I think coming out of it was more detrimental to my body than the joy I felt being in it. I felt great when I was doing it, but then going back to normal life was rough. It was rough.
Well, I've got mixed feelings about cleanse because they're based on the idea that we're full of toxins we need to eliminate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's BS. You know, we're not full of toxins. Our bodies have evolved for millions of years to have kidneys and livers to get rid of our toxins, okay? And the idea, it's a sort of medieval idea that we were full of putrefying food and we need to cleanse it. So that's, its premise is rubbish, but I had a few colonoscopies for science, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did feel slightly elated after my fast and purge for a short while. So I can see why people do like them, but I think there's no evidence long-term they do any good at all, really. There's no evidence for them.
Is there one specific diet trend that's popularized that you think is total BS? Like one specific one, and just that you personally are like, ugh, that is the worst. It is total BS.
I think it's things like the alkaline diet would be the most sort of crazy ones.
What do you mean by the alkaline, like anti-inflammatory diets?
Well, they all change name, but it was like, if you can change the pH of your intestines, you'll solve all your problems. So it was that one. And that's led to lots of people dying. People used to go to this ranch in California to get cancer treatments and were given drips, you know, to try and change the acidity of their blood and things. And
well, weren't they also doing the Gerson theory at the same time? How do you feel about like the validity of that, just out of curiosity?
No, it's all pseudoscience, unfortunately. So all this stuff, and they'll keep coming up, you know, and they'll change the names and do other stuff. But we've got enough amazing things happening in real science that we don't need to come up with wacky theories that end up with someone selling you some magic potion or supplement, you know. Mm-hmm. And the microbiome is just so amazing, and we've got treatments for it, which is called food. We just need to work out how to put those two together for individuals, and you know, we can all be our own alchemists. We don't need some guru to tell us how everyone's going to be cured, you know. But humans, you know, we like those gurus, you know. Sometimes we
I think it says it's empowering the individual, which by the way is what Zoe's doing. Like I feel much more in control of what I'm doing. I think that's a super key factor here, that people feel like they don't know what they're doing, and so they trust all of these things that actually aren't helping them at all, and sometimes they're doing the opposite. So I think the education part of it is the most important, but how do you teach all these people stuff when they're being taught How do you counteract that and make your theory more believed than what everyone's been told for so long?
Yeah, well, I think it's a step change to say, listen, don't believe what everyone else is talking about. This is all focused on you. You know, you're testing yourself. You get your results and you see what's happening to your body in real time. There's no bullshit. You know, you can see it for yourself. The scientists behind it are publishing real papers, and you can, you know, in real journals, top journals like Nature and other ones, and work in proper institutions. So there's a real difference between something that's driven purely by marketing and things that A, you see yourself, and you can go on the website and actually see that this this is real science. But, you know, and I think this is the big change. And I think once you start to see this technology changing in real time, you know, you can go and make your glucose level go up and down. You realize that if you had, you know, someone else, I mean, when I did this to my wife, we had the same meal, we had completely different responses. And, you know, and hers were much better than mine. It was really annoying. But that's real life. And that really brings it home to you how personalized this is and how everyone in a way has to go through their own journey, and they might as well start now.
I must say that you're such an advocate, obviously, for real science and saying that there are all these journal, you know, all these, this information is out there. But the reality of it is the majority of the average educated intelligence person doesn't know this information, doesn't know it exists, and is just eating what the signs are telling them to eat. So how do you think that can be changed? Does that make sense?
People like you,
you know,
people listening, people telling other people about it, people reading, you know, books like Spoonfed. You know, I think it's a ground up movement. The government isn't going to change anything
because
they're being bribed by the food industry. And, you know, everyone's happy in that scenario because food is cheap, and governments in the US for the last, you know, 60 years have basically kept people happy by the foods being ever cheaper. And that's been the number one.
Yeah.
So I think it's a grassroots movement that I think is growing. People saying, let's not believe everything we're told. Let's understand ourselves. Let's find out about real food. Let's educate our kids about real food. Let's start from scratch. And, you know, and if you can actually cook yourselves from raw ingredients, you don't need to rely on labels. I mean, that's the other thing, you know?
Yeah.
And if every kid learned this at school, and there are increasing numbers of these food kits that you can get. So if you say, I want to try being a month vegetarian, I said, well, I can't. What I can do is cheese on toast. You know, you can buy these meal kits now that would just step-by-step instructions on how to cook fantastic vegetarian meals. So I think, you know, everyone who hasn't made that shift, because, you know, when I went veggie, I couldn't cook veggie meals. I needed some help. And that, I think, is a big way of doing it, empowering people, not only to pick the right foods, but also know how to cook all these vegetables together to make fantastic dishes.
Would you ever serve fast food to your family, and do you ever eat it?
Yes, would I serve it to them?
Like McDonald's, like, could you ever buy, like, I would never.
I gave McDonald's to my son for 10 days solid.
But that was for a study. Like in general life, would you ever choose McDonald's or any or Taco Bell or serve it to your kids? If you had little kids today, knowing what you know, would you ever serve your 6-year-old McDonald's?
No, but I realize you probably couldn't protect them forever against it. Mm-hmm. So rather than them running away and getting it, I might in a way do it as an experiment with them and say, this is what, you know, McDonald's tastes like, so you don't feel like the only kid who doesn't have a TV, you know, so I think it's part of, it'd be better to do it and say, well, listen, this is how they make a chicken nugget, you know, and show them a video. This is what, the reason this, you know, the bun is so tasty is basically it's full of sugar. You know, all these little facts, and the only fiber is in that little gherkin bit. I would feel, you know, I'd want to show them how to cook basic dishes with vegetables, how to cook, chop up onions, make a stir fry, do all this kind of stuff. I think that really should be the duty of a parent now, like, you know, happens in other Mediterranean countries, but we've lost it in our countries, you know.
I don't think you've ever been to Ohio here in Cincinnati. Let me tell you, a lot of that type of stuff ain't happening.
You do ribs. You do ribs and barbecue, don't you?
We do. And a big thing here, which people in Cincinnati... Yes. How do you know that? Have you been here before?
I used to work with Procter & Gamble, so I used to come there, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Skyline chili on a hot dog with cheese on top of it. And then we also do it on top of spaghetti chili as well. So it's like spaghetti noodles, chili, cheese, and a bunch of other stuff in it.
I ate it all. But as a novelty, if you're a tourist going to Cincinnati, you have it once, out of the way, then you go back to real food.
Okay, so in general, I was recently told I had a lot of kidney infections like 2 years ago. I was hospitalized 3 times in 12 months for bad kidney infections. And so since then, they've told me never to take ibuprofen again. So what is the damage in my mind? Like, if I have inflammation and I need to take ibuprofen, is the ibuprofen I'm taking messing up my body more than the anti-inflammatory properties that I'm benefiting from? Does that make sense? Which one's worse? Which one's better?
Well, it's a trade-off, and you've got to work out, you know, obviously taking ibuprofen increases your risk of getting infections, but it doesn't cause them, okay?
Okay.
So it's not a direct cause. You obviously need the bugs and other things to happen. And you may be fine with a short course of, if you're in real pain and you find it's the only thing that works, but, you know, we wanted to try Tylenol first rather than ibuprofen, you know, look ways around it. In general, you know, you always want to reduce medication use to its minimum anyway. That's sensible. Who knows, maybe try next time with probiotics and with lots of kefir, you know, have a nice pot of kefir every time you pop an ibuprofen and see what happens. We're all experimenting. No one knows the answers to this. Your doctor's just been cautious because they don't want you to get infections, but they probably don't care, you know, if you have pain. I was a rheumatologist, so I always had all the gastro guys were telling my patients never take any pain medication, and they're saying, "Well, I can't walk, doctor. What do I do?" So, you know, it's always a trade-off.
How do you feel about gluten intolerance, everyone being gluten-free now, and how do you feel about gluten intolerance in general?
I think it's been hyped up by the food industry. So that's the other problem. They're making huge amounts of money on gluten-free products. And it's a whole new line of foods for them generally cost 2 or 3 times as much. So you've got to realize that commercial pressure is driving a lot of this. And 9 out of 10 people who are gluten intolerant do not have gluten allergy. And which means when you I think studies have shown only about a third of them, when you test them with gluten, actually have a bad effect. So some of those people, it's real. In others, it's imagined. That's the reality of it. So really? I think people need to calm down about it and realize that it may just be what they're eating. Maybe they're eating really bad sandwiches with all kinds of other stuff, with bad bread. They just need to look at the quality of what they're eating rather than blaming everything on wheat or whatever it is.
But what if they read Wheat Belly? Like, I got halfway through Wheat Belly and was like, okay, I can't even, you know, you read that book and you're like, the gluten is ruining the world, but you're saying like, no, it's not that isolated.
Well, never believe anyone who's got a simple solution to the world's health and nutrition problems is never correct, okay? It's, as I said at the beginning, it's complex. Anyone who's blaming one thing, you can blame iron, you can blame gluten, you can blame microplastics, you can, blame the Chinese. You know, you can do whatever you like, but it's never going to be a simple thing. And write a book around one single factor and make it get a bestseller. But it's never going to be the truth because, you know, we're complicated beings. We're meant to be omnivores. You know, we were brought up that way. And so we need to take a global view of what we're doing. And what I hate about this reductionism is saying, well, everything's gluten, everything's this, you know, everything's this chemical, it's not enough magnesium, I haven't got enough zinc, I haven't done this. You know, it's missing the point. The point is, if you've got a really good varied diet on your plate, you're going to feed your microbes right, they'll produce thousands of good chemicals, boost your immune system, and everything else falls into place. And you can do that a number of different ways. But you can't do it if you're restricting everything, if you're frightened about eating, and you know, you're on this really crazy restricted diet where you're taking out most of the good stuff.
I think we're fighting how much people can actually understand and how much they care about what you're saying, health and gut health, which is the most important thing to humans. Health is wealth, right? So how do you empower and teach people these things when everyone is on a different level of education and or interest? So you got to simplify it in order to reach as much people, hopefully for the greater good. But if that's not possible, then aren't these other linear avenues important in ways if they're doing some good?
Not unless they're, you know, helping identify food quality, and things like gluten are not. They're driving people to more ultra processed food alternatives. So actually they're having a negative effect. And that's my worry. They're just getting ultra processed food reformulated, another form, more expensive, and restricting diets. So I think some of these things are actually harmful.
Yeah.
Very few of these fads are increasing people's diversity of whole foods, you know, increasing the organic movement, increasing people's knowledge about what good food is. And I think that's key. So that's what I want to reverse. And I think that's what hopefully people will remember, you know, from this chat is there isn't a simple solution other than, you know, look after your gut microbes and, you know, and we're all unique. Those two things are the central thing, and there isn't a quick fix. This is, you know, you've got to do things that are going to be sustainable for years. And that's really the mission now.
Well, this is great. This has been amazing. We've talked for a very long time. Thank you very much for giving me 90 minutes of your time. I feel like I could talk to you all day. And as this is a great passion of mine as well. And thank you for teaching me so much. And hopefully everybody else is learning a lot as well. So
my pleasure. And yeah, so people can follow me on Instagram. I can follow Zoe on Instagram. And there's obviously the Joins website if people want to go and get tested like you have. Find out for themselves what it's all about.
And I would also recommend your Twitter game is strong as well. So you're an expert in very many things and you're very vocal on Twitter, which is very interesting to follow.
Twitter's all about COVID though, so we're trying to forget that.
You know? Oh, no, but that's a complex issue that's ripe that we have to...
We can't start that conversation. We'll have to do another one on that.
We will not.
Okay.
And, well, there you have it. I feel throughout that conversation, he was like, you need to stop obsessing over these specific issues. Look at the broad picture, which is huge. I know I do that personally, and I think a lot of us do in general. And that's the key that I'm taking out of this is to diversify and not overwhelm yourself with so much information on one topic. Look at the entire broad spectrum and remember that how you're feeling in your body and how your food reacts to what you're putting, how your body reacts to the food you're putting in it is the most important thing. So health is wealth, babes. Love, light, whatever it is you do today, make yourself proud. Like, subscribe, follow, share, all those things. Remember to follow Tim on Instagram and at tim.spector and also at joinzoe, Facebook at joinzoe, and online at joinzoe.com. And my Zoe evaluation recap will be coming up here in a couple weeks. All right, we'll talk to you next time.